Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome to the Converge to Accelerate panel on translational applications of AI in healthcare. My name is Dimitris Kalogeropoulos, and I'm moderating this panel. And together with us today, we have Sandeep Reddy, Zach Holdsworth, Alexandre Lebrun, Adam Chee. Let me take a minute before we start with the panel discussion to give the opportunity to the panel participants to present themselves and tell us a little bit about their interests in generative AI and its different uses today. Thank you. Adam, would you start, please?
Thank you, Dimitris. Hi, my name is Adam Chee. I'm currently serving as the Chief of Smart Health Leadership Center over at the National University of Singapore, at Singapore. So I'm a health informatician, and my current work on AI lies with regards to generative AI, looks at explainable AI, because we have to make sure that the systems that we recommend or implement can be used in a clinical setting. And I'll be talking a little bit about that.
Thank you, Adam. Sandeep, would you please introduce yourself and tell us what your main interests are?
Thank you. I'm Sandeep Reddy. I'm based in the Deakin School of Medicine, where I'm the director of the MBA Healthcare Management Program. But important to this conversation is I'm an AI and healthcare researcher. Like Adam, I'm also a health informatician, but I'm also the founder and chairman of MediAI, which is a globally focused AI company.
Thank you, Sandeep. Thank you so much. Alexander, your turn.
Hey, my name is Alexandre Lebrun. I'm the co-founder and CEO of a startup called Nabla, and we are building an AI assistant that helps doctors enjoy care again. So it will automate lots of administrative and clerical tasks for doctors. It's called Nabla Copilot. Before Nabla, I worked for 4 years with Facebook AI Research. As a lead of engineering. And before Facebook, I had two startups in AI that were acquired, the first one by Nuance Communications and the second one by Facebook.
Thank you, Alexandra. Congratulations for that, for your acquisition, I mean, of your startup. Adam, shall we start perhaps with you? I think it's a great way to set the stage to start the conversation going. If we discuss a little bit about explainable AI in the context of LLMs, what we're hearing about, what we envisage, which way we envisage this whole thing is going to go. And it would be great if you could help us a little bit with translation, the uses of AI in translation in that context. Thank you, Adam.
So first question, where it will go? My personal belief, and I think a lot of people in the audience may agree with me, it will fundamentally change how we approach health and healthcare in general. And the reason why I say this is a lot of the methodologies we do right now in terms of delivering health services, they are deductive by nature. So we eliminate possibilities. So that's one. With good AI systems in place, of course, having good data, we can do predictive and deductive approach at the same time. And so far, trials have shown that they are very effective. And this is where the awkwardness comes in. In healthcare, we are very evidence-based. And sometimes we require evidence even though things are looking good. So let me give you an example. Research studies have shown that for kids, young kids, when they play, they usually break their right arm. And that makes a lot of logical sense because the right arm is our dominant arm. You ask any mom, they'll tell you, yeah, chances are they'll break their right arm if they fall because that's how they break the fall. To make a statement, I actually work in a hospital where we have to acquire data just to prove what we know. So this is healthcare. This is medical. We are evidence-based. You know, anecdotal evidence are great, but please back it up with evidence. So this goes to the topic I'm going to talk about, which is explainable AI. Now, AI, as we are aware, is usually of black box of nature. So we know something goes in, there's some magic happenings, and it comes out with suggestion that so far, of course, AI of today that we have seen, it's pretty good. So you've seen ChatGPT, they actually make sense. In a lot of suggestion, it writes beautiful poetry, it can give you quotes. Now, does it necessarily understand what it's doing? Maybe. we don't necessarily know. But the outputs are usable, verifiable, and you can actually repeat the action. So if you apply the scientific process, it will pass. It's a, you know, you can repeat the test, and again, it gives you a good answer. The question is, it is at times unable to explain exactly how it comes to a certain conclusion. In this context, with health and healthcare examples, it will say, you know, perhaps you can do this, and it may be able to explain its deduction. But it is not clear enough, if you will, unlike a human physician who actually will cite relevant examples, the AI may do as well, but doing it with context. So there are many, many ways that generative AI today has tried to handle explainable AI by using rule-based systems, localized explanation, model-specific examples, but it's still falling short. It's still falling short. We need a little bit more rules and regulations training. And why do I emphasize on training? The problem with healthcare systems is that it differs from countries to countries, regions to regions. There are many, many clinical protocols which are all good because we're evidence-based. So if you take COVID as a good example, different countries handle COVID differently. You wouldn't have any country comment and says, the other guys are doing it wrong because they are doing it right, even though everyone is doing it differently. And the reason why is that we're able to deliver evidence of our approach. Of course, we change our approach when the evidence show otherwise, but that's the common approach. And this is something that we need to look at, especially in my part of the region, because a lot of this great stuff, for example, what Alessandro is doing, is it's going to be concentrated in the North American market. I'm not saying that you guys are doing it wrong. You guys are doing it differently. And different sometimes, as you know, may not be well accepted. So that's what I want to share about explainable AI. I think the technology is great. So to answer again the first question, it will fundamentally change how we approach healthcare. We can actually go into preventive health if we have data, including genomic data. Could reduce a lot of costs. And yeah, the future is exciting. I'm just looking to see what's up next.
Okay, Adam, thank you so much for that introduction. We're going to come back to you, the subject of explainable AI. Perhaps we're going to go around in a circle a little bit to get everybody else's contributions on this subject. If I could ask you a couple of questions, though, can I very quickly, just to keep in the back of your mind, if you can answer them now, please let us know how you feel about it. If not, we can come back later because Sandeep will bear on this subject as well. So the first one is, what is the difference between predictive and deductive explainable AI or AI? Because a lot of people get confused about this. Sometimes it's one of those cases where you have to go back into reference textbooks to make sure that you distinguish them properly. And the other one is, you know, you use the term evidence-based. That can be really confusing as well. So when you say evidence-based ways of clinical practice and AI assisting with that, what sort of evidence are you referring to? Are you referring to evidence of correspondence? So when for example, antibiotics don't work with this particular problem because we have observed they don't work, or are you talking about precision medicine where we acquire evidence to support more, you know, systems medicine approaches to evidence? Which one of the two is it?
That's a lot of questions.
So okay. Let
me answer the second one. Of course, we can use current AI technologies and they can help provide guidelines. So in their opinion, this might be the better treatment, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, factoring things into consideration will be local culture and context. But if we do go into predictive, there are possibilities and there's many use cases that have shown that alternative treatment plan that wasn't immediately clear to the physician or the healthcare professional. Now that becomes tricky if you suggest something, if the system suggests something novel, it could be a better solution. But there's no prior evidence, if you will, or no prior evidence on hand.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be tricky. Yeah.
Completely understood, Adam. That's great. So we're talking about evidence then in the case of what has been published and what has been tested and tried and is closer to a gold standard rather than what makes more sense from a clinical point of view, a systems medicine point of view. So Sandeep, I would like to bring you into this conversation right now because I think that your perspective is very valuable in making that transition. So I'm keeping what Adam said. I understand that there's a gap between black and white box approaches to AI. We're trying to bridge that gap. Can you tell us a little bit about how evaluation can help with that, Sandeep? Thank you.
Yeah, so thanks for the question. I'll just build on what Adam's already outlined in terms of explainable AI because it's an important constituent of evaluation. But before I get to that, I want to justify the case for evaluation. Why do we need evaluation? So I'm a medical doctor by background. We know in clinical medicine, we come across every day new and newer therapeutics, interventions, technologies that promise a lot. But when you actually apply in practice, and especially in the scenario of healthcare, where if things go wrong, it affects the patients, there's adverse events, and untoward effects. So we really have to be very careful in judging any intervention, it's safe and is effective for you. So from that point of view, evaluation is a no-brainer. So now in terms of evaluation of large language models, so we have had linguistic metrics for natural language processing for a while. We have had measures like GLU, BLUE, ROGUE, and so forth. These are all acronyms. But with the emergence of large language models and the way they process data with the utilization of transformer algorithms and also the outputs, you obviously had to customize or devise new evaluation metrics. When we look at the evaluation metrics that have emerged recently, there's perplexity, which gauges the prediction value of these large language models, but there's also human evaluation measures which I've added. There's an additional layer, which includes a measure of the coherence, a measure of the overall quality, relevance, and fluency. But in a recent paper, I said, even those are not enough. You need to add additional two layers. That's the translation layer, and then there's the governance layer. Let me unpick each layer. Translation layer really focuses on the integration of these large language models, especially in the clinical context. You need to have any generative AI or large language models well integrated into the hospital or the healthcare information system, so there is a seamless workflow and it doesn't add burden to the clinician. So from that point of view, a translational assessment is really important in the very early stages so that you don't have deployment of applications, large language model applications that can add burden to the physician and not get used. And then in addition to the translation layer, I also advocate for a governance layer. And that goes to the points which Adam made earlier about the explainability or transparency of the large language models. When we look at large language models, they usually use neural networks and a transformer kind of algorithms. And we know with those kind of algorithms, the decision-making process is opaque. And generally, it's fine if you're to use them for identifying your airline tickets or asking a simple question, but in the clinical context, you obviously need to know the reasoning behind suggestion of a particular therapeutic or particular medical intervention. So explainability really is important. Fortunately, we nowadays have a lot of explainable frameworks, Shapley values, local interpretable LIME kind of things, and with other with the emergence of developing explainable AI science, we are going to have newer metrics and newer frameworks around that. But there's also other components that we need to cover in the governance that includes issues like who becomes responsible when things go wrong, when things go awry. So that medical legal accountability is important, and also ethical aspects, the kind of data that you use, because we have seen that with AI applications, there's introduction of biases because of the kind of data they use, but it also can lead to discrimination against a vulnerable population. So it's important to have that ability to understand the kind of data that's used, but also to prevent or mitigate any biases that may be introduced. Then the other aspect is whether the LLM abides by the regulatory processes. So in the US, we have the FDA approval process. Similarly, in the UK and other countries, we have equivalent regulatory processes. So it's really important that these applications have been vetted and have been approved. So it kind of like is very complex, but I think this large language models, what it being called foundational models, and with the hype around it and what it can do in clinical medicine, which we're going to talk about in terms of use cases, I think it's important to also have an equivalent and comprehensive evaluation framework.
Thank you, Sandeep. So do you think there's a fundamental difference in how in old school natural language processing, so the way we used to approach NLP applications and LLMs in terms of integration into the use case environment?
Yeah, so myself was involved in developing a biomedical text mining application a couple of years ago. We even won a Kaggle medal around that. But what we had was a very simplistic model with the emergence of transformers and utilization of transformers and the human reinforcement learning aspect that has been added to the natural language processing models. I think we are looking at much more powerful models, and some people have even said they have contextual reasoning, which I doubt, but if we were to take their word, we are really looking at something that is very unique and novel, that's unlike before. My fellow panelists may add to that, but I guess from that point of view, definitely we are looking at something quite different and very novel. Some people have gone as far as to label the large language models as foundational models, setting as the foundation for future AI or future AGI, artificial general intelligence. So it goes as far as that. So from that point of view, I think we're really looking at something very different from what was existent in the past.
So perhaps a massive acceleration, Sandeep, in that case.
I would say
Alexander. Thank you. Thank you, Sandeep. Alexander, Alex, I think prepared, Alex, Sandeep prepared the ground for you rather well when he mentioned burden to physicians. I think that Adam and Sandeep also brought up some very important subjects that revolve around that. So would you please tell us what your experience is about LLMs and how can we best assist with care workflows and everyday work. Thank you.
Yeah, first, thank you. Just to complete what Sandeep said and Adam as well, I've been doing natural language processing for 20 years, and I've seen three stages, three eras. The first one before 2010 was the old style grammar, with rules, rule systems, big grammars, dictionaries, and it was very, very limited, very fragile, but fully explainable. You can explain any output. But it was very brittle. And then starting in 2010, 2012, we started to use deep learning for doing NLP, and it changed everything. We just threw away all the grammars and use simple classifiers and name entity recognizers, things like that. And it was more powerful and but a little bit less explainable. It was a bit harder to know. Sometimes it didn't work. But still, we can deconstruct the output of the system. And now, of course, we are all using LLMs for NLP. It's much more powerful. It enables us to do things that we couldn't do before, definitely. But it's not explainable at all. And I think this is a kind of paradox with machine learning, is the more powerful it becomes, the less explainable it is. And I'm very pessimistic about, and I know you guys are working on that, so I don't want to be the too pessimistic, but I'm very pessimistic actually about the explainability of the future LLMs, bigger LLMs and the future system post LLMs, because when you have 50 billion parameters in a huge black box, how would you explain any decision, any output made by this thing? as the very way it's built, you know, it's a huge autocomplete. So for me, LNLM is a huge autocomplete system. That sounds all right, that looks good, but it just, you know, guess one word after the next to make an output that looks reasonable. But it's not even proven that you should use an LLM for reasoning or to do deduction. We can use it like that, but we don't really know if we should trust these outputs. And so on one side, I think it's an extremely powerful tool. On the other side, I think we should be careful about what we do with it, which applications we are choosing. And so, for instance, in healthcare, I wouldn't use an LLM to do a chatbot for, you know, like an AI doctor, the chatbot pretending to be a doctor. Actually, when GPT-3 came out 3 years ago, at Nabla, we tried to build a chatbot doctor just for fun. And initially, it worked really well. We were quite excited. And then after 5 minutes with the first patient, a dummy patient, you know, it was us, it just told the patient, okay, maybe you should kill yourself. So it was impossible, not the one thing, you know, you want to see in production with in a real world. And so it was impossible to predict that suddenly this chatbot would say that. Again, it was GPT-3, not 3.5, not 4, but I don't think it's a good idea to do that. So at Nabla, we use LLMs to understand, to synthesize the consultations. So we get the audio from a doctor-patient consultation and use LLM to make the clinical documentation of these consultations. So we synthesize the data, we generate the notes, you know, so like a SOAP note, and we normalize ICD-10 codes, CPT codes, you know, and so on. So we use LLMs just to understand and to structure information, but we are not doing any clinical decision, even decision support. We are just trying to save a lot of time for the physician, but the physician will read the note and make edits if needed. So we drew a very clear line of what we are trying to do with the LLM as opposed to what we don't want to do, like diagnostics and so on. So I think it's important when you do a real world application to not being brought away because it looks so powerful. You may be tempted to do more and more with your LLM, but I think it's easy to make big mistakes if you do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Alexander. So where can I start from? So let's recapitulate first, repeat first the most important part you said. You're concerned about the conversational aspects of LLMs. I would come back to all of you and ask you what do you think the conversational aspects, I mean, why are we putting so much emphasis on the conversational aspects of LLMs? Because the way I understand it is that LLMs, as Sandeep and Adam said earlier, they're an evolution of older, and you, Alexander, they're an evolution of older NLPs, approaches to NLP. So, you know, when I was doing research in the UK on artificial intelligence a very long time ago, 25 years ago, we were talking about NLP and how we can implement NLP in different uses. So fundamentally, not much has changed in terms of technique. Transformers are very important, but again, the background technique is more or less the same. What we have seen changing is the approach, the democratization, let's put it this way, of the technology, the fact that whoever is preparing those foundational models says to people, help me evaluate, help me build the foundational models, and then you can reuse them with our investments, so you can deliver the last mile, you can deliver the disruption to the market. How do you feel, Adam, on that statement from your perspective? You're on mute.
Sorry, Adam. I was muted. I think fundamentally there are merits to what Alex has said, and I do agree to a certain extent. So back to your point, Demetrius, there's some fundamentals that has not changed. And that is a pro and a con. These two points are actually correlated. So allow me to explain. We are training all these systems with the methodology that we are familiar with. So to take Alex's point, we have a situation you take current technology, build it in a chatbot, or rather ChatGPT-3, put it in a chatbot, as a chatbot. And within a few minutes, the chatbot actually asks the patient to go and kill him or herself. A human will do that as well, an untrained human being. So you have people who, if you put them in the unfit role, they are not trained for, they may potentially be saying similar things. So from that baseline, the chatbot is not necessarily worse off than a human being. It's just mimicking potential human behavior. So that's how I see it. And it goes back to Dimitri's point, because we are still using a lot of philosophy that was inherited. Now, is that wrong? Absolutely not, because it has proven to work and you will actually drive further innovation until one day we return our mind around and how to reuse the technology that we have built on, fundamentally open up a new paradigm on how to utilize it. And let me give you an example, because I just had this conversation recently with someone on how we can potentially use this technology in healthcare. I mentioned earlier on, I'm of the belief that in the future, potentially in the near future, we will fundamentally redefine how we deliver healthcare. The reason why I said this, today, we actually do a lot of deductive work when it comes to medicine. So a patient will come to a healthcare professional and says, well, I'm not feeling well, so what's wrong? I'm having flu. And then perhaps the healthcare professional will do a lot of tests to eliminate possibility and to confirm suspicion areas. Sandeep is a physician, so he may be able to articulate it better. But fundamentally, that's how it works. You know, you're trying to eliminate the possibility and confirm what you know. And then you try out treatments. So it's very common to have situations where a patient visits a healthcare professional and then maybe some medication is prescribed. And the healthcare professional almost always says this: you take this medication, you try it out. If it doesn't work, come back. Because this is the process. But with proper data, and this is important, proper semantic data, that includes a genome, the environmental data, you can do your lifestyle data. You can do preventive work out front and say that here, you know, based on your genetic makeup, based on the environment where you work in, maybe there's you're next to a nuclear plant or something, or, you know, maybe you're next to a farm, et cetera, you're higher chance and prone to getting X or Y disease. Then this is where the magic happens. You actually fundamentally change the way. So you should be taking some of this medication that prevents you from getting certain disease. You should be observing some behaviors, et cetera, et cetera. So this is where it gets me excited. But if we were to go down the route where we try to replicate the human limited methodology of trying to figure out how to deliver healthcare, AI will still be able to do that. But it will be the classical jiggle example, because we're limiting the possibility of generative AI in doing some of the work. Now, having said that, I don't think it's going to happen now or tomorrow, but eventually. And that's how I see it. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Adam. That's fantastic. So you actually answered my first question, right? What is the distinction between deductive and predictive AI in a fantastic way as well? Thank you so much for that. Okay, but I'm going to insist on this point here for a minute to pass on the conversation to Sandeep. Nabla is non-conversational. Okay, fine. But there's most of the applications of NLP and LLMs as foundational models are non-conversational. I don't see the pessimism about the wider concern out there about conversational AI. The way I see it, conversational AI is an interface used to guide the training process, and it should be used as an interface. The language should be used by professionals. Certainly not by lay people, people who connect with Google Health to ask whether they should take XYZ drug or, a friend of mine called me, said to me the other day when I was concerned about the problem, stop being Google doctor, trying to, tell me off about the fact that I was reading about conditions, although I'm not a medical doctor as such. So there are plenty of applications out there. And Alexander, the way I see it, I think they all influence clinical decisions. I don't agree with you because somewhere down the pipeline, the information processing pipeline, that information will be that is processed by AI will reach eventually clinical decision in through populations, through guiding pathways and workflows. It will reach. It will have a clinical decision support function. And having said that, I also want to note that LLMs are published in uses, fantastic uses to read, to identify patient-reported outcomes in medical records, to process referrals, to audit referrals and make sure that they were correctly made based on the information in records, unstructured information, and so on and so on. So again, I'm gonna for this reason come back to Sandeep and ask you, Sandeep, what is the exact how can we use evaluation to make sure that not only do we evaluate the technical correctness of the LLMs, but we evaluate the proper use of them. Yeah, how would you tie that to regulation as well? Thank you, Sandeep.
Yeah, so let's step back a bit as to what's regulation and what's evaluation. So evaluation has been around as long as regulation has been. Regulation is focused on a very narrow aspect, whether the particular medical device or a software as a medical device is going to bound to cause harm to the patients. So their fundamental focus is about the harm aspect. And when you look at Therapeutics Good Administration, which is the equivalent to FDA here in Australia, their classification of medical devices is entirely based on whether the particular device is to cause a harm or a risk. If it's at a higher risk, it goes into a higher classification or a higher categorization in terms of the regulatory process. So evaluation is much more comprehensive. As you rightly pointed out, Dimitris, it's not just looking at the harm or the outcomes, but it's also looking at whether it's going to integrate with the information system and whether it's going to be adopted by the end user and whether it has the features that makes it much more acceptable for people. And one point which you made very much resonated with me, Dimitris, you said democratization of healthcare and the usability of ChatGPT. And if you look at the way ChatGPT as an AI application has been adopted by the general public as opposed to the previous AI applications, you can start to see why it's so. The reason is it is publicly accessible. User interface is very, very simple. Even a person who is barely conversant with computers, who has very little knowledge of how computers work or AI works, can use it. So that aspect with previous AI applications. So I've been working with AI for nearly 6-7 years now. I even have developed AI applications, and both as a researcher, but also as an entrepreneur. And these kind of AI applications, the way they were developed, the way they were presented, were quite complex and very restricted and very narrow in its use, obviously, because machine learning has a very narrow focus. And we haven't achieved that level of general purpose or multimodal AI yet. It's going to happen. So those were really restricted to either to academic centers or to particular hospitals or to particular labs. So now we have ChatGPT available for everybody. And that's really changed the way vendors, researchers, everybody works. I've seen clinicians who are very, very dead set against AI now saying, hey, there may be a use for AI for this purpose, whether it's an administrative purpose or whether it's to do with patient education or it's to do with clinical decision support system. So from that point of view, I think we have to understand that evaluation is becoming much more important because now If we let go things as it is and just focus on the regulatory aspect, say FDA has approved it, it's all in good. In fact, a study of some researchers here in Australia from Macquarie University, they did a study of the post-FDA approved applications and found many of these applications had issues which FDA didn't take into account. So you can still have issues emerging even after FDA approval or any regulatory process approval. And that's where evaluation really helps, because evaluation can be done at the development stage, it can be done at the deployment stage, and it can be done at the post-deployment stage. So a couple of years ago, if the panel can indulge me and the audience can indulge me, I'll just plug in a shameless plug about a comprehensive evaluation framework which we developed. We had an international team which I was part of, and we developed a comprehensive evaluation framework which is termed as TEHI, which is an acronym for Translational Evaluation of Healthcare AI. So without interest of time, I won't go in detail of that, but I urge all of the listeners, the audience, to actually look for it. It really explains how you can develop an comprehensive evaluation framework. And post to that, we said it's not good enough to develop an evaluation framework. There are a lot of frameworks, there are a lot of guidelines which get published and do not get used. We wanted to validate it. We took that evaluation framework and applied it to COVID AI studies, to over 100 studies, and we published that. And that's also been recently published. So you wouldn't be surprised about the results, but I encourage the audience to have a look at those two papers.
Thank you. Thanks, Sandeep. So if I may say, then you feel that we still have quite a little bit of work, to do to make that transition from black box to white box, including functions and regulatory issues that are not a matter of evaluation as such, right?
So let's make it a scale. Why do we have the black box situation? So perhaps Alexandra is a relevant person to explain this, but let me explain it from the way I understand it. The whole black box situation arose not because of machine learning or classical machine learning algorithms. In fact, decision tree models, random forest models are entirely interpretable AI. So the whole situation arose because of neural networks. And as Alex rightly pointed out, when you look at large language models, the billions of parameters and a lot of weights and a lot of things, which makes it mathematically impossible to get any kind of explanation process. What we do with explainable frameworks is an approximation. We look at the saliency mapping. We look at the features that are important and say, this is likely, these are the features that result to this outputs and so forth. So from that point of view, I completely understand Alexander's skepticism about explainable AI doing anything good with large language models. So I've taken a different route. I said, why should we always focus on neural networks in deploying AI applications? Can we look at classical machine learning algorithms? Can we look at symbolic architecture? Can we look at expert systems? I mean, I know that they don't do very well with complex hierarchical data. They don't do very well with in terms of the accuracy and performance compared to neural networks. So a lot of people have moved on to a transition to neural networks. So I can understand that with low-risk situations, but with high-risk situations, for example, the example Alexander mentioned, say you are looking at a stroke patient or looking at CT of a high-acuity situation, and you want to make a decision and you want to make a call, or if it's in an intensive care unit, you want to make a call to put a patient on ventilation. So those kind of high-acuity situations, you need some sort of confidence whether the AI application can explain what the decision is and why it's arriving at the decision. And at that point of time, I say, we have focused so much on neural networks and all this explainable AI science. Can we actually go back and see why we should always rely on neural networks? Can we look at alternative approaches? So I come across something very novel. Some of you may have heard of it. Some of the people who are listening to this may have heard of this. It's called hyperdimensional computing. It used to be called symbolic vector architecture in the past. So it's very much replicates or simulates the way our brain works. So neural networks, in spite of what it is called, doesn't really exactly replicate the way our brain works. Because when you look at the mathematical structure of neural networks and look at the way the neurons are architected, are placed, they don't necessarily represent the way our cognitive process works. this hyperdimensional computing actually very much is very similar to the way we think, the way we our brain processes process our thoughts and the brain works. So I encourage people to not just look at hyperdimensional computing, but look at alternative approaches. Can we look at that? Why do we always rely on neural networks? It's not just about the black box situation, but it's also the computing cost. Large language models require enormous computational
cost. Okay. Yeah. Okay, Sandeep. Thank you. Thank you. If I can just wrap this up very quickly. I understand that Adam, you're going to have a lot of work to do your domain. I mean, because it's all about explainability. I think that there's a lot of work going on out there. That Bayesian classification networks are still very much alive. Old expert systems. I understand that we're going to see two dimensions going in parallel in the future, at least in healthcare. One is the old school evidence-based medicine, where we're making correspondences between evidence and outcomes and a lot of heuristic classification. The other is we're going to see LLMs applied in many different ways to help us with doing the more intricate things that have to do with discovery, primarily perhaps in searching for clinical notes and clinical data, which is hidden and not being used because people are not good at processing so much information. So we need to give it time, and perhaps explainable AI is a very good way to do that. We need to give it time so that we can come up to speed with what developments we're witnessing, machines enabling and pushing forward. But I wanted to, and thank you, Sandeep, for that explanation. I want to go back to Alexander now and ask you, if I made the statement, tell me if you agree with this. So do you think that LLMs can help us start barking up the right tree, perhaps?
Maybe I sounded too negative about LLMs, you know. I just wanted, because of the, as you said, you know, ChatGPT is a chat. So we tend as human to anthropomorphize, to think it's a person, and then to have too high expectations. And so the form of the system as a chatbot makes it very dangerous, because you think it's a human in front of you, and you want to project your fantasies and your what you've seen in science fiction movies, you know, to ChatGPT, but it's still incredibly powerful and incredibly useful. And even if it's not, I think it's not explainable, but as Sandeep says, with good evaluation, you can, you know, like a human person driving a car, you cannot prove mathematically that there will be no accident. And of course there are accidents. But you have statistics, and you can see how many times there will be an accident. And if your AI system is not explainable, but is demonstrated through evaluation to have less accident, then it's a good system. So I think we should have the same approach when we use LLM in healthcare. And as you said, Adam, like maybe a human as well would have suggested the patient to kill themselves. So I think this is a very, very good approach, but I don't see that a lot yet. We people tend to think that AI systems should be perfect, and that you should be prove that they are perfect, which is impossible. And also, even in some cases, if we cannot use an LLM in production in healthcare because it's not proven enough yet, we are using them to create data sets, for instance, to help us be very, very efficient to create data sets with the LLMs. And then we can use these data sets to train other systems that are easier to explain or more controllable, as the ones you mentioned, Sandeep. So I think also this ability of LLM to do MVP, you know, quickly to try something in a controlled environment and then get data from that is very interesting.
Very good point, Alexander. Very good point. And I think there's a lot of that fine-tuning projects out there that a lot of startups are focused on. Adam, thank you, Alexander. We'll come back to you in a minute. Adam, how do you feel about that statement? Would LLMs help us to start barking up the right tree? in the sense of making a transition to more predictive medicine and more predictive applications of artificial intelligence. How do you feel about that from explainable AI point of view?
I think it would. You know, there's always pros and cons. If you go for a philosophy perspective, there's no right answer. It's just what is more contextually suitable. So the short answer is yes, I think LLM can help us in a way, but it's the person who is using the tools should be in a position to actually maximize the potential of the tool. So the short answer is yes, but it really depends on who's using it. I'll give you a healthcare example as well. Now, healthcare professionals comes in all forms. If we were to just concentrate on a physician persona, there's still different types of physicians. And each of them are potentially trained in different areas, some better than the other, if you will, for the lack of a better description. So if you have a general practitioner asking the same question as a specialist of which of his or her domain, the answers may be the same, but your knowledge will vary. So the short answer is yes, it can definitely help us, but it's really up to the person using the tool to maximize it.
Yeah. And where do you feel, thank you for that, where do you feel we are in terms of translation right now? How far are we? If we gave it a scale, and you know, one was we started research into how we can use AI in healthcare, and 10 was AI is, you know, our right hand in healthcare. Where do you think we have reached now, and how much of that breakthrough that happened with LLMs have helped us to progress in that scale, on that scale?
I'm not sure if you're going to like my answer. It depends on where you are.
I need your answer though.
It depends on where you are. So you are in Africa, where you have a shortage of healthcare professionals. What we have right now is actually a godsend, because the alternative is people die. You know, there's a sure death. Whereas if you have whatever we have right now, it's not perfect, but it's good enough to deliver some insights, you know, guide, maybe nudging the healthcare professional to think about certain possibility. So in those settings, oh yeah, this is a godsend. Advanced countries where we have laws and regulations, and you know, we are looking at this. Actually, I like what Alex said early on. The problem is we expect AI to be perfect. There's no unicorn. Yes, you can start drawing up the specifications of a unicorn. You can articulate it. We can discuss it. But there's no unicorn. There simply isn't such a thing. So we think of AI as perfect. We can actually define the specs. This is what we want. Let's build it. It's not there. So low resource country, godsend. Right now, today, you bring it to the United States, you bring it to Singapore, you go to UK, Australia, we will nitpick. So it's not there yet. But actually, it's pretty good in some settings.
I love your answer, Adam. And just to chime in, I think even in developed countries, you know, in the US, for instance, with a shortage of staff, of clinical staff, we are, access is becoming like closer to actual like Africa, because we are missing so many doctors and nurses that eventually access will be almost impossible, and then AI will become more attractive. So that may push AI as well.
So Sandeep, I'll come back to that. Alexander, thank you for that engagement. Sandeep, how do you feel about that? Summative versus formative evaluation. So what we're saying here is we come up with an end product, we statistically evaluate it, so how often it fails, and then say this is acceptable. Do you think this is something we can go with?
Yeah, look, I don't like applying formative or summative terms to the evaluation process I described earlier. I'm rather looking at the continuous quality process that we undertake in healthcare. And we also term it as clinical governance, where there is a constant, consistent monitoring and evaluation process that occurs around clinical interventions, clinical treatment. So from that point of view, there isn't any formative stage or a summative stage in the evaluation process I described. So it's a continuous process.
Okay, all right. So involving both of them.
Yes, you mean involving formative
in a cycle.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's, and then so you agree that the LLMs then in that case made us start barking up the right tree, because this is their fundamental difference, is that we're now accepting that we can allow LLMs. That's what everyone said, Adam and Alexander. So we are accepting that we can allow AI to come into clinical practice, even though it's not perfect, because of certain conditions, X, Y, Z, whatever those conditions are, shortage of staff, the workforce of the future, wanting to support, for example, complex deliveries, pregnancies being managed by midwives instead of gynecologists in many countries because of a shortage of specialized doctors. So we can look at the wider picture, see where our healthcare systems are today, and question ourselves and say, where can artificial intelligence take care of things that are more mundane, more repetitive, and set acceptable levels of possible failure. But the question then is, how do we define gold standards if in that larger framework? How do we make sure that we're happy with where we've reached before we start thinking like that?
Yes. Let me clarify. Large language models, what we are looking at with ChatGPT and Bard, these are decoder models. They're not even encoder decoder models. So within large language models, there's a tree, evolutionary tree, and within that, there are several branches. There's encoder decoders, encoder decoder combinations, and then what we see with ChatGPT, a decoder. So from that point of view, I'm not very optimistic large language models by themselves will be able to do everything that we are expecting them to do. So I'm thinking the way AI in medicine or translation AI in healthcare will be around multimodal AI. So that's the way a clinician or physician works. We take into account text data, image data, sound bites, everything, and then we process it and through our experience and expertise, relay a treatment or a management advice. So from that point of view, I'm very optimistic. Once we get to that point where this multimodal AI, already Bard is offering ability to analyze images and also text data. Again, large language models, ChatGPT, are autoregressive models, but the name itself kind of puts some limitations around that. But if you talk about multimodal AI, I think I'm very optimistic, Dimitris, that this is the way medicine will be able to work with AI. And AI works alongside a physician, enables a physician to spend more time with the patients and do the kind of things that human beings are born to do and are much more capable of doing.
That's fantastic. Alexander, education, research, or care? Where do you see which of these three applications do you think is going to accelerate faster, or would all three of them work in unison in a repetitive cycle?
Education, definitely. Research definitely, and I think everything about productivity, so this is what we do at Nabla, but making doctors more enjoy providing care again, helping them to get rid of all the back office things they had 50 years ago they didn't have to do, but now they have to do, like filling the EHR, things like that. So I think we should focus on these things first, and care will definitely come in the last because this is a more dangerous where we need to prove that we are not doing anything wrong. We need to go. We don't even have like you say, the gold standard or a baseline. So we are. That's why it will take time. Definitely, it will have a huge impact there eventually. But I think this is. I see that as like a second phase because of the risks, and the perception of the risks is much bigger.
So let's focus on workflow, research, education. Let healthcare professionals do what they always do and join forces with them to let them find the right uses for the technology.
Exactly. I think, many startups, we did that mistake when we started Nabla three years ago. We first tried to do diagnostics, and then you can do diagnostics with AI. And then one day I realized, okay, actually, doctors, they love to do diagnostics. They never feel that it's a problem in their job to do diagnostics. This is the best part of the job. And you come as a startup and say, hey, I will do this part for you. So this is a very bad go-to-market strategy. And so And then we learned slowly, okay, they are spending 50% of their time. It's an actual number, 50% of their time doing low-level tasks. So let's do this first. And then maybe we have a right to try to do more for them. But it's a temptation that many startups have to start with on the wrong problem. And we did that as well.
Okay, guys, we have 2 minutes left to wrap up. Adam, I think the panel discussion has gone fantastically well. My first question was predictive versus deductive. What you mentioned, brought up as your first point, I think we went full circle into how education, workflow, and research can support a transition from old way of doing things, of being deductive, of focusing on the diagnostic, the differential diagnosis part of healthcare professionals, physicians, what they do when they deal with patients. Perhaps, we should focus more and use the opportunity, start backing up the right tree to use LLMs to help us with processing that vast space of information and to turn that to our advantage, to use it for explainable AI, to use it to develop better regulation to support the around the circular nature of evaluation as Sandeep described it, and eventually perhaps support the whole digital health integration into clinical care process through that. I have less than a minute left. I'm just going to say that we should have a follow-up panel discussion, because every Absolutely. Single point that you touched today revolved around data. And data is my expertise, data in AI, and how we can use data for productive integration of artificial intelligence in all these different use cases that we discussed. But that's a massive, very big space to touch upon now. What I want to do for now is I want to thank you so much for being here with us today. I very much enjoyed our conversations. Thank you for sharing your insights and your experience on artificial intelligence and LLMs. Hope we can continue this conversation offline after the Converge to Accelerate conference.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great day. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.